MacCast, Monday, May 28th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I am excited about today's episode. I think you're really going to enjoy it. As you know, we are in the weeks kind of leading up, I guess almost to the last week leading up into Worldwide Developer Conference. And when that happens, the Apple news kind of slows down a little bit. But I have been secretly hoarding a number of news stories specifically related to the topic of Apple and music. There's been a few of these over the past couple of weeks, and I wanted to cover these, but I wanted to do it with someone who is a little bit more of an expert in music, kind of followed the music scene a little bit more closely, and was also a fan of Apple. And I found that person in my friend Brian Ibbett from Coverville. So I invited Brian on, I gave him the outline of these stories, and we're going to get into those in this special edition of the MacCast. So stay tuned for that. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. This week, I want to talk to you about PDF Pen 10, the new version of PDF Pen from Smile. It is out now, and it still is the ultimate tool for editing all your PDFs, just new and improved, even better. PDF Pen 10 adds the ability to add watermarks to your PDFs. You can now set custom headers and footers. So along with your page numbers and all that stuff, you can put additional information in the headers and footers across your entire document. They have a new precision editing tool that's going to help you with editing your text and images. And with PDF Pen 10, you can now move images around without increasing the size of your document. You can also magnify the library items, make those a little bit easier to see. And there is a new improved color palette. And if you go for PDF Pen Pro, the Pro version of 10 adds the ability to batch OCR your documents. So you can go paperless even more easily and take a whole collection of PDFs and scan those in, OCR them, and make them searchable using PDF Pen Pro 10. And don't forget also that Smile offers PDF Pen for iPad and iPhone, so you can take your documents all on the go, edit them, get all of that great PDF Pen goodness in a portable format. And of course, they allow syncing, so you can take your documents from desktop to mobile and back again with total ease. As always, you can learn more about PDF Pen and PDF Pen 10, the new versions, by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. And don't forget, while you're there, check out their blog. They've got a bunch of great helpful articles and tips and tricks for using PDF Pen. And if you're already a PDF Pen customer, don't forget, you'll find information on the website also about upgrade pricing. And they do offer that. So check out smilesoftware.com/podcast. And a big thank you to Smile for their continued support of the MacCast. Well, I don't want to waste any more time. I'm super excited about today's episode, so let's just jump right in to covering some of the latest Apple and music news with our friend Brian Ibbett. Hey, Brian, how's it going?
Good. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me, Adam.
Hey, thanks for agreeing to be on the show. I can't, you know, I was looking back. I don't know that I've ever had you in the, what is it now, 13 years
I've been doing this?
And we've known each other for probably 12, at least 12, if maybe not all of those 13.
Yeah.
I've never had you on the MacCast, and that's a shame.
We're not label mates. That's the music equivalent. We're podcast empire mates.
Right.
Yeah, backbeat I guess. Media mates. I don't know what the yeah. phrase is. But.
Yeah. Anyway, you know what I have in my hand right here? By the way,
I'm going to guess that it is a set of poker chips from the Coverville 500 concert.
I pulled these out. I've got Jonathan Colton here.
Oh, those
I've
were so great.
Natalie Gelman. Let's see who else is on here. Richard Cheese, of course.
Of course.
Dan Klass.
Don't talk about that on social media. Oh my gosh, not the Richard Cheese one.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, we won't get into that.
No, that
if you want a podcast history, that's another show. It's another podcast.
That's right.
And the only one that's not here is The Radio Adventures of Dr. Floyd, because my daughter was a big fan of the show and she took that one. So she has
that. She stole it. Nice.
Yeah. So quick introduction for maybe people who don't know Brian. Brian is the host of the long running music podcast Coverville. He plays cover songs. I'm sure he'll tell us a lot more about it and has been around in podcasting as long as I have. If you don't know his stuff, you definitely should check it out. And again, we'll give you all the info so you can do that toward the end. But Brian, you know, I wanted to get you on here because lately there's been quite a few Apple Music stories. Yeah. And I wanted to get some of your thoughts on this because, you know, you're not in that industry, but you're closer to it because of the show that you do, especially around things like you have. I know from the early days, because when we were doing music on podcasts, you know, you do a music show. So you've had to deal with organizations like
licensing.
RIAA and then
ASCAP, BMI,
CSAC, all these places. Right. And so this stuff comes up in these Apple News stories, and we talk about it from a facts and figures standpoint. But, I really have no connection or perspective. So sure. I thought it'd be fun to get you on, go through some music stories, and you're an Apple Mac guy too. So
I've been a Mac guy since the 80s.
You have that side of it. So we're going to get into some of that. We're going to get into HomePod and Apple Music and these music stories and things like that. So Brian's joining me for this episode, kind of a special episode of the MacCast, and I really appreciate having you here.
Oh, dude, my pleasure. So happy to be here.
All right. So one of the more recent stories that has come up is surrounding Apple Music and subscriber growth. I guess this is an ongoing story, right? The whole battle between the streaming services, and we don't get into it too much. Right. Yeah, I mean, well, I guess right off the top, do you have an opinion about that? Like, just, you know, you've got Tidal, you've got Spotify, I mean, you got Pandora, you got Apple Music.
The only one I use with any regularity is, in fact, Apple Music. The library is immense. I'm finding stuff. I do a show with Hammond Chamberlain called Soundography, where we listen to an artist's library, their entire catalog, from their debut album to whatever is most recent. And then at the end of that week, we do a show where we talk about their biography, their history, their peaks, their valleys. And we even make a playlist of songs that aren't on the greatest hits that were like, if you get the greatest hits and then accompany it with our playlist, you'll have like the best combination of deep cuts and pop tracks. But a lot of times we don't have, you know, we're picking fairly obscure artists for most of these, and we don't have all those albums. So Apple Music has just been a godsend for having a lot of these. And we'll find that there may be songs or albums that aren't available on Spotify that Apple Music has.
Interesting.
And it's just a natural, for me, it was just a natural connection to Apple Music. I use a lot of their music services. I use the Apple Match or iTunes Match.
Right. Do you have a sense of why you think the depth of Apple's catalog might be larger than, say, a Spotify? I mean, because Spotify's been doing it a lot longer, right?
And Pandora's even been around longer than the two of them. But I don't know. I mean, is it the fact that Apple is – it's hard to say that they're more of a known quantity than – Pandora and Spotify.
Right.
Apple's music offerings, their music library and subscription service, haven't been around as long as those other two. However, Apple has been around longer than those other two. And maybe that's a deciding factor for labels to say, all right, well, you know, we trust Apple. We're going to hook up with them for streaming services for this music. And
that's my sense of it, too, is the longstanding industry relationships starting way back with iTunes, right, is probably more likely. And the fact that they hire guys like Jimmy Iovine, you know, and they bought. And we have to remember, too, they didn't just jump into streaming on their own, right? They bought Beats, which had heavy hitters in the music industry already on staff. And, you know, they sort of bought their way into a lot of that. So I think that factors into it as well as one of the first stories that I want to talk about. So Apple's been seeing, you know, great subscriber growth. They added supposedly 2 million subscribers in the 2-month period between March and April. So about a million subscribers per month, which is, I think they're growing faster than any other streaming music service right now. Probably like a lot on the back of their marketing. And there's some analysts that think they're going to grow about 40% year over year for the next 3 years. And I'm guessing, you know, catalog is part of that. I think for me, another part of that is music discovery. Like, mm-hmm. they're curated playlists. I don't know if, were you ever a Spotify subscriber or user? Like, I tried Spotify in the lead up, and I tried even Beats for a while in the lead up to Apple Music. And neither of those services ever really clicked for me, but I think it's because of my listening patterns. What I kind of find is between the different music services, it seems to be, you know, what kind of listener you are. And I'm what I call a shuffler. Like, I usually want like a genre or, you know, a style of music or something based off a certain kind of artist. But then I'm fully willing to let an algorithm or something sort of just shuffle that for me. I'm not a playlist person. So I don't know how
I'm the same way. No, I'm the same way. I want to discover stuff that is similar to what I really, really like, which is, you know, what all three of the ones we've talked about offer: Apple Music, Pandora, and Spotify.
Right.
But I don't want, I don't want somebody's pre-planned playlist that just happens to contain one of the artists that I like. You know, I want basically to start with musician or band or song A, and 90% of the people who like this song also like this song. Mm-hmm. And discounting what the first step was, now we're on this song, and what are the big connections for this one? And it's kind of more of a, I don't know if this is the way one of them works versus the other. This is the way I assume Apple Music works versus the pre-planned playlists on like Spotify and Pandora. But instead of it looking at, here's a playlist that happens to contain the song you like, or maybe contains the artist you like, it feels like each pad, mm-hmm. each song that you move from or move to in Apple Music is now the starting point for the next choice that comes out, which seems to take you into further directions than staying within a preset path. Like, okay, you're only going to hear new wave, but you might hear some deep cuts new wave that you're unfamiliar with. Well, you'll start new wave, and then you'll go to like Kaiser Chiefs because they were inspired by new wave, and then from Kaiser Chiefs you might go to Arctic Monkeys because there's this connection, and I really like that.
Right. Yeah, I think I don't know. I mean, a big thing about Beats and now Apple Music was human curation versus just algorithms. They mm-hmm. use algorithms as well. I know that there's some sort of mix. So I don't know if they maybe use algorithms to sort of build a set of things, and then they start to curate playlists from that. I would imagine that something like that goes on, but that's just what I'm guessing. And that's been one of the things that Beats always marketed was, you know, we're people who love music, you know, humans that are actually putting these things together. And I think maybe that's why those connections can
probably
happen,
helps
right?
a lot. Yeah, for sure.
Right. Yeah. So I don't really know. So, I mean, massive growth in the streaming industry. And we hear about this all the time. Like, you know, we're in this transition from people buying music to streaming music. Actually, this just made me think of something that I want to ask you about that's not in the show notes. So I'm going to deviate just for a second before I get to the thing that we're talking about. Because I want to talk about royalty rates and how this stuff affects artists and things like that. Because the music industry, we know, has gone through a lot of stuff with technology between MP3 and Napster all the way through iTunes. And now we're onto this streaming thing, right? There's fluctuation. Mm-hmm. I just lost my train of thought because I was going to ask you about...
It wasn't
royalty related. All right, well, let's move to the royalty thing. It'll come back to me.
Okay.
Apple is still they're thinking 40% growth over the next 3 years in Apple Music, although they're saying that that's probably not going to generate a ton of revenue for Apple. Because unlike their hardware products where they're getting, you know, 30-40% margins and things like that, with the royalties and stuff they have to pay out and the overhead for running a streaming business, you know, it's more like that 15% rate.
Sure.
So they're saying, you know, it's this high cost of royalties being paid to labels and artists. And this gets me thinking that, well, labels and artists especially are often complaining that, hey, we're not getting paid all that much on these streams. Right. Like, this is a big deal. And as you'll hear stories like, the music industry is making more money, you know, this year than they were last year, according to the RIAA. You know, 2016 revenues were up from the previous year. you know, and these are numbers that I have, and I'm bringing up 2016 because I found a report in 2016 that said revenues in 2016 for the music industry were half of what they were in 1999.
Oh, wow.
With half. You know, like that's
crazy.
That's how far they've fallen. So we're in a build back up, but I think people don't realize, you know, back when we were kids, you and I were kids, and we were buying cassettes and CDs and albums and stuff like that, right?
Right.
There was a lot more money in this industry.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, the streaming has basically turned everything on its ear, no pun intended, with where the money's coming from. How people consume music obviously is so much different. It was a hard thing for me to go from the lifestyle of, okay, I want this music, I have to pay for it, I have to own it. And now it's like, oh, okay, well, I can just stream it. And I have the same access to it. I can listen to it while I'm in the car. I can listen to it when I'm at home or you know, flying somewhere. I can download an album, a streaming album to my phone without buying it. I don't own it. And if I ever leave Apple Music or whatever service I happen to be using for that, it's gone. Right. So it's a whole different mentality of like what you own versus what you borrow.
Right.
Or what you stream. And so really the whole music industry has had and is still in the process of figuring out what that exactly means. Like how – if you pay Apple Music for a subscription and you get all this music available to you, do they take what you pay for a subscription and divide that up among the things that you listen to annually? No, that would be one way of doing it, but it's not the way they do it. No, I mean, they actually do like have a stream payout. And if you're someone who listens to music constantly, kind of like I do,
right.
You're basically a loss leader for,
right.
you're a loss point for Apple. Because you're listening to more music than they make from you to pay their licensing.
Yeah, they pay they basically pay a nominal rate per stream. And we're going to get into some of those numbers in a second. So if people are wondering what those are. But I mean, basically the way it works is for every thousand streams, or actually every stream, there's a monetary value.
Right.
And what Brian is saying is exactly right. If you're a person that's listening to more streams, you're costing the service, basically Apple, more money. And they're counting on that fact that, you know, some people are going to subscribe to the service and only listen a little bit. And there'll be a few that'll listen a lot. Like I know I am a ton because I constantly have Apple Music on. I work at home. I have a HomePod now. And the first thing I do when I get to the office is I ask it to start playing things, and it plays all day long. And if I get in the car to go anywhere, if I'm not listening to a podcast, I'm streaming Apple Music. So I'm probably streaming, you know, almost 10, 12 hours a day, I would bet, if I added it all up very easily.
And I don't know if – I think restaurants and places of business where they actually have music playing constantly, there's a different – they can't just do Apple Music, right? There's a thing in the licensing agreement that says you can't publicly broadcast.
Right. Yeah, you can't publicly.
You know, in your store or whatever.
The reality, though, is like most places
I'm sure there's a lot of mom and pop places that are like, yeah, of course I've got Apple Music going all day long.
Right. I mean, and they've got a HomePod or they've got an Amazon Alexa speaker or something in the corner,
You know, right, exactly.
And, you know, back in the day, it used to be the radio or whatever it might be. But yeah, but I did remember the thing that I wanted to ask you about because it's kind of related to this is there has been these rumors recently that say Apple's considering stopping selling music, that they're only going to do streaming. So what's your thought on that? I mean, do you ever see that being a reality, or is that just, I know my opinion, so I'm,
yeah, I don't see it actually happening. Yeah. It feels like the, artists obviously make more money from people buying their music versus streaming their music. I mean, totally makes sense. For me, that would be a huge thing because anything I play on my shows, I actually physically have to own. I can't play something that I'm just streaming from Apple Music or Spotify or Pandora. Mm-hmm. I actually physically have to own. Well, physically, I could still own a digital copy, but,
right, but you have to have purchased an actual.
I have to have purchased license. Or been given it to a by a label, which is about 80% of the stuff that I play on the show is given to me by a label. 20% of it is stuff that I go out and find on my own, buy, and then contact the label and say, "Hey, can I have permission to play
right?
You know, this batch of songs.
Well, and then so people know you have to pay royalties on all that stuff too.
I do, and the good news is I don't have to pay the kinds of royalties that a radio station would have to pay for playing more popular artists. So, like I said, 80% of the stuff comes from the label. That just inherently comes with the permission, although if it's not super clear from the label, I still send him an email and say, hey, you know, right, cool if I play this on the show. And 100% of the time they say, oh, yeah, of course, yeah. So that permission basically means that I don't have to pay Sound Exchange or the Harry Fox Agency ridiculous amounts of money to be able to play that music on the show.
Right. Because I'm assuming because it's considered kind of a promotional thing. Is that
it is. Yep, okay, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And you're as long as the person who owns the mechanical rights of the song gives you permission, then that's the key
we're
thing
gonna
right
talk
there.
We're going to talk about that too here in a second.
Oh, good. Okay.
But yeah, excellent. So stopping selling music. I'm in the same camp, right? I just don't see, there's no, my opinion on it from an Apple perspective, you know, regardless of what the user, what the artists or the labels, you know, sort of take on it is they already have an infrastructure in place for that. They mm-hmm. already have mechanisms for doing that. And it's just added revenue. Like, what's the point of taking away someone's ability to buy a track if they want to buy a track? There's just not a lot of extra things. You know, they already have exactly. that stuff in digital form. They're not warehousing a bunch of CDs like yes, right. They have to have some staff to manage it and they have to have servers and stuff like that, but like the added cost, and if they make a bit more money, great. It also keeps exactly. I think, like you said, the record labels and the artists happy. The counter argument to that is that people aren't buying music anymore, like right. slowly. I mean, every year the number of actual digital downloads that are purchased, you know, purchased downloads is declining pretty quickly. So that's
for
sort
sure.
of a counter argument.
Yeah. If I wasn't doing a show that required me buying music, I'd probably stream just about everything. Right. Yeah. Cause it, even my favorite bands, it's like, all right, if I wait, especially the ones that are only in the UK, for example, I may have to wait 6 months for their music to be available here. I could buy an import now, but you know what? Oh, I'll just wait 6 months. Right. I'll be able to stream it here. No problem.
Yeah. And unfortunately I've fallen into that camp too. I mean, I used to buy a lot of digital music, and I don't think since I've got Apple Music, I've purchased anything. I can't.
Yeah.
My daughter does occasionally. Because mm-hmm. she likes to have, you know, she likes soundtracks and a lot of Disney stuff. But yeah, sure. Me personally, I haven't bought much music.
It doesn't cost Apple that much more to have a buy button instead of a play button, or in addition to a play button for streaming. Right. So you're exactly right. I don't think it's going to be going anywhere.
So what this is leading us into is the meat of what I wanted to talk to you a little bit about is this thing with artists. You know, how does this affect artists and their ability to make a living and do things like that? And there's some data that I want to share that we can kind of predicate this conversation with. So this is data from the RIAA and also from Tricordis. So two organizations that recently did some looking. RIAA obviously knows what music services, streaming services are paying to artists. The Tricordis is an artist community blog.
Okay.
And so they did more of a polling of directly of artists. And so it's a lot more independent and unsigned artists, you know, where the RIAA has a whole mix of this. And according to both, they kind of came to both about the same conclusions that Apple pays about $8, around $8, it's just under, it's like $7.83 per 1,000 streams of a song to an artist. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That sounds about right.
Spotify pays about half that. About $4.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize there was such a disparity.
Well, and so let me clarify that disparity. The difference is that Apple does not have a free tier on their service. And a lot of people don't know that when you're streaming the free stuff, I think it's similar to, it ends at the royalty rates end up being similar to radio. And I also think to a certain degree may play into some of the things you were mentioning, Brian, about not having to pay some of those fees.
Mm-hmm.
And so they average about $6. So where Apple is paying $8 per 1,000 streams, about Spotify is paying about $6 for the streams on the paid service, but they only pay about $2 for everybody who's on the free tier.
Gotcha. Okay.
And I think they have about 160. I'm trying to remember how many million subscribers, and about, I think I want to say about 60 or 70 are paid. Mm-hmm. Something like that.
Okay.
So they have like 100,000 free and like 60 or 100 million free and like 60 million paid or something.
That are paid. Okay.
Right. Whereas Apple, I think, is up to about 40 million paid, what we just said. Something
I think that's
like that.
Right. Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. So, and then Google and Amazon are at about $6 and $7.50 respectively. So Apple pays a little bit more on average for paid subscribers than the rest of the industry. And that plays into, I think, another reason why they have a few more, a little more stuff in their catalog than some of the competitors.
Right.
I think
that's a lot more label agreements or a lot more labels.
Ironically, Tidal pays about $1.30 per thousand streams.
Oh, really?
They're almost double everybody else. But they have such a small market share.
It's a very limited
streams. Yeah, they only represent about 0.5% of the streams. Apple accounts for about 11%, 10.5% of all music streams, and Spotify is about 48%. Wow. And then what's interesting out of all of that is that actually Apple generates about 22% of the revenue, despite only having about 11% of the streams, whereas Spotify is almost one for one. They're about 50% of the streaming market and about 50% of the revenue.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's very interesting. And then you have YouTube. I mean, then you get into YouTube, which is really popular, I think, among kind of unsigned artists, but also the younger generation of kids. You'll find, if you talk to them, a lot of them get their music through YouTube streams.
They do. Yeah, they're discovering music that way. And left, left with autoplay turned on, YouTube can act a lot like some of these other services, because they will go to the next recommended video. And if you're listening to music, it's probably another one by the same band, maybe another one by a solo artist that came from that band. And I think with advertising, this is actually a new model that you're seeing for artists today that probably complements what they make with streaming is what they make, what percentage they make from advertising on YouTube. I know a lot of that goes to Vivo, which is, just heard today, Vivo's going away, but comes from a lot of these things like advertising that they get from their label putting up a bunch of their videos up there.
So here's the unfortunate thing, though. On the streaming side of it, YouTube pays around, I saw varying numbers, but it looked between like $1 and $1.50 per thousand streams. So whereas Apple's paying $8, YouTube is paying far, far less.
That's paltry. Yeah.
No kidding. So what got me thinking is like, this is seems like a huge disparity. And I think this is what you hear about from artists and labels complaining that, you know, like streaming, how do you make, and so my question to you is, how do artists deal with this? How do they make money in this area, in this era of, you know, streaming growth? Because streaming is only growing. So they're making more money every year from streaming. But as we said earlier, compared to what they were making when they were actually selling music,
CD sales and stuff. Yeah,
it's like about half. And like I think about like that. If in a short period of time, my revenue, you know, my income was dropped in half, and I had to kind of start over and build up. I mean, that's got to be frustrating.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Just with new technology that's supposed to make things easier. Like, oh, great. You mean I can deliver my music digitally to my fans instead of actually having to have vinyl pressed or CDs pressed or things like that. I seem to remember, when streaming and even when digital purchases were starting to come into play, I remember hearing, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, that bands were starting to say, okay, well, we make more from merchandise sales, concerts, touring, and everything. Anyway, with CDs, and I also have to say that it's probably digital purchases as well.
Right.
The label gets a big majority cut of that, and way, way less of a cut for concerts and merchandise sales and touring and stuff like that.
Right.
So if you're an indie band, I mean, one of the best things you can do is, number one, be a self, you know, try and figure out a way to be your own label.
Right.
Weezer did that. They left, I can't remember who they were with, Polydor. No, capital maybe, and then they decide to go on their own and start their own label. A lot of bands have done this, and I think it's a good, you know, artist-owned labels, I think, are a great byproduct of what's been happening. And then just get out there as much as you can. Make merch, sell merch, especially these services that don't – you don't want to end up with a warehouse full of T-shirts. So the new models of like Merchly and things like that that do kind of on-demand merch creation. I hate the phrase merch, by the way. I got to say merchandising. Yeah,
that's fine.
It's one of those abbreviations that I just never got behind. But that is, I mean, you know, selling T-shirts, selling posters and pint glasses and whatever bands sell these days,
right,
is a good resource for them to be making
money.
So
use streaming as a promotional vehicle. And I think we're seeing some of that, right? I mean, this is like, let's use these services like we did radio or other things back in the day, and this is how people find our stuff, and then we can market to them in other ways, you know, get them on our Twitter streams, get them coming to our concerts, buying our merchandise.
Exactly.
And things like that. This rolls back, though, to another one of the complaints about, you know, big music services like Spotify and Apple is the discovery systems, you know. And again, that's I kind of like Apple Music because I am discovering new artists, but there's often a question is, are they doing enough for up-and-coming artists or unknown artists or unsigned artists, right? How does an unsigned artist who doesn't have a label in there, you know, talking to Apple executives saying, here's our next big star. We want you to put them featured on the homepage, or we want you, you know, they're not ones who can go in and say, I'm going to do a Taylor Swift exclusive launch on Apple Music, right? No one's
right.
So, you know, how does that play into all this too? So I guess the question often that's thrown out to our community, and I'll throw this out to you, is should Apple be doing more for those artists? Do they need to do more? Are they obligated to do more for those artists?
They're not obligated, but it sure would be really cool if when you're doing your music discovery, if artists, independent artists who also had their music featured or included on Apple Music, carried the same weight in the algorithm or in the curated playlists as the stars. If you start a Taylor Swift song, you know, in Apple Music, and like, all right, well, yeah, find more stuff like this. Will it maybe find some other female solo acoustic musicians who are independent, or will it just go to like Camila Cabello and then over here to Demi Lovato and just other pop, pop starlets? It'd be really cool if they carry the same weight, especially if you do the job of telling them like, oh, I'm not a big fan of the Demi Lovato super arranged stuff. Let's hear some more acoustic stuff or some more independent stuff. It'd be really cool if you could, if they'd carry the same kind of weight.
Well, and what's great about, and that is actually often one of the advantages that people will point out in streaming music too, is that if an upcoming artist could get on a featured playlist or something like that, along with a major artist, because you're paid per stream, right?
Right. Right.
You've got more people listening to that entire playlist, so your song's going to get streamed more, which means more revenue for you, right?
And that's where things are so different than they were in the radio days.
Yeah, it does level the playing field at that, because you're getting paid the same rate regardless of, you know,
whether it's a star or an up and coming or an indie artist. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is, and I'm saying that as a generalization, I think certain artists are able to go in through their label or just through their artist power and get a little better deal. I know some of that goes on too. We've heard about that. Like,
oh yeah,
Taylor Swift can walk in and say, I'm going to give you an exclusive and you're going to give me $12 per stream or $15 per stream for this album or whatever it might be. I'm pretty sure some of that stuff goes on.
Well, it's the title model, right? Where you're exclusive. Here's, you know, I'm only going to release it to Tidal, or only going to release it to the specific group, and in exchange for hire.
Yeah. So the last thing on this royalties thing that I did want to ask you about, because this came up in the news recently too, there was a ruling, I think, in January with the Copyright Royalty Board to increase songwriter rates for interactive streaming or published. I think they call them, and this was confused me too, and maybe you can explain this. Like, I saw it references publisher rates in some articles and then songwriter rates in other articles. Are those, it seemed like those would be different things to me.
I would think those are, and I've heard the term, you know, the publishing ASCAP is, I think the P in ASCAP, Is it an American songwriter? It's not publishing. Performance? I should know what each of those stand for. But they have been, on some of my licensing agreements, used interchangeably. Songwriter royalty versus publishing. And I think it is because when you are a writer, you're having your work published. Whether or not it gets recorded is treated separately. But right, Prince, okay, in addition to recording his music, he also published his writing with, I believe he was on BMI or is on BMI, or his music, I should say, is on BMI. Right. So when somebody covers a song from Prince, it's the songwriter royalties or publishing royalties is what I'm paying to BMI.
Well, I know with publishing rights or songwriter rights, they've been kind of they don't get the same per stream, and they are actually trying to push for a per stream revenue model. So they're monetized a little bit differently when it comes to this stuff. But this ruling that came down in January, they're going to be increasing, telling the streaming services they need to increase what they're paying these songwriters and publishers by 50% over the next 5 years. So they're being forced to kind of drive it up. What's interesting is they don't get paid per stream. Like I said, they get either one of two things, either a percentage of revenue or a percentage of the total consent costs, whichever is greater. And the consent cost, I guess, is the payments that are made to the label.
Okay. Which makes sense. So I wonder if this is to combat how many artists, will use cover songs to kind of paint my colors. Right. We'll use cover songs to kind of introduce themselves to a new audience. Walk Off the Earth, for example, and that massively viral cover of Someone Like You, Gaudier's that Gaudier song where they had all five of them playing on one guitar. Mm-hmm. That was such a huge thing. And as much as that song got streamed, Walk Off the Earth would have gotten all the royalties for that with a little bit of any publishing and not publishing, any release of music, digital and CD purchases going to ASCAP, BMI, CSAC, whichever one it was. But maybe this is a way of saying, okay, with so many new artists using cover songs to kind of expose themselves to a new market, we need a way to gain revenue from that as well, especially if they go huge and go viral.
Right. Yeah. So I don't know. It's fascinating to me how, streaming is changing kind of the landscape, but at the same time, it just seems like artists have always struggled, maybe that's some of this too, right? Like none of this is new. It's hard to be a creative professional or person or break into an industry like music or movies or television or radio or whatever it might be, right? It's always kind of been a hard row to hoe. Is that right? I don't know how that
That's right. Yep.
Goes.
Hard row to hoe. Yep. I think we're still in the flux part of this. It's still the adjustment phase. I don't think that what we're seeing now is what they're eventually going to settle on. I think this is like the nailing a 2x4 to kind of create this little bridge here and a little bit of duct tape and baling wire and all that sort of thing to kind of fix what's over here. I think in 10 years we'll probably see music agencies, licensing agencies and songwriting agencies probably have something a lot more well-defined for how artists get paid, whether their music is streamed, bought, or covered.
Right.
I think it's going to be very different in 10 years.
And I will just conclude by saying, I mean, we mentioned that Apple pays a little bit more than some of the competitors per stream. And, they'll point a lot to their sort of background and history and their relationships with artists and the fact that they do want to make sure that this is a viable business for the future, right? They're trying, they are trying in their little way. Now, at the end of the day, though, too, you have to remember they're a company that's trying to make money and compete as well.
Of course.
So, they have those two sides of the coin that they kind of try to ride. And so they're not always on the good side, right? But I think overall, I get the feeling that Apple is trying to be more about the artist, more about promoting the artist, because like a lot of the things that they do at the end of the day, they're a lot more interested in making money from selling the hardware and the products around the music than they are from really the music itself. Like the having a music service is for, I think, Apple in a lot more ways about selling more AirPods and devices. HomePods and iPhones, and than it is about, you know, making massive profits off of the backs of music artists.
I think so. Yeah. Exactly. It's more of a it's more the sugar that gets delivered with the spoons they sell.
Yeah, totally.
Right.
So there was another little thing that happened, the Music Monetization Act. I was going to ask you about that, but I didn't really get it too much. I'll bring it up really quickly. Sure. Basically, I guess there's been this problem with streaming services and music that was sold and produced and made before 1972.
Right.
Yeah. And there were some lawsuits that happened, and what this act would do, it passed the House, I guess, past couple weeks. Really what it means for streaming services is that if they follow the new rules that are in this act, and I guess it's combining a bunch of different acts for music, for older music. So there was something called the Classics Act. That applied to works written and recorded before 1972, the Fair Play, Fair Pay Act, the Music Works Monetization Act for songwriters and publishers, and then some other, the MP Act for producers and engineers. It kind of combines a lot of the language of all these together. And what it means for streaming services like Spotify and Apple is that if this passes and they follow the new rules that are in here, they can't be sued.
Right, exactly. If an artist is not on the up and up and record something that they're not licensed to record or distribute, probably is more appropriate,
right,
then Apple can't get sued by streaming that or selling it to somebody.
And the news on the story is that, you know, sort of all the big guys, RIAA and ASCAP and all these guys, are all for this thing. None of the big streaming services have come out in opposition of it or anything like that. Interestingly, the only organization that was kind of in opposition to it was, I think, XM Radio for some reason.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I didn't get the gist of why. Yeah. It wasn't really clear in the article I read. But anyway, that was another little story that came out somewhat Apple related. You know, I don't know if anything's going to come of that. Right. And then another thing. So another thing that gets brought up a lot when you start talking about Apple Music and Spotify, because people like to pit those two together or against each other a lot, I guess. Mm-hmm. Spotify made some changes to their free tier services a couple weeks ago, and there were a number of news outlets that were like making a big deal of this. But when I dug into it, I don't know if you're aware of what the changes were, but basically on the free tier, I guess you could listen to playlists and stuff, but they were always shuffled and you didn't have kind of the ability to go song by song or on demand. They're changing their rules a little bit on the free tier. I guess they have these 15 discovery playlists in different categories. And there's music in each one of those playlists. So they're curated playlists. I think they're built by Spotify.
And they're changed daily,
right? Mm-hmm. So anything in those 15 playlists on the free tier now, you can play on demand as much as you want, whenever you want, in whatever order you want. But it's not like full free reign access to, you know, everything in Spotify like you would get if you went to the paid tier. Right.
Sure, because it's a limited number of songs that you get. You now have your choice within these limited number of songs to listen to them in the order that you prefer, as opposed to that's where you could listen to these songs, but we pick the order.
So there were all these outlets kind of, Apple's, you know, and they're going after Apple Music, and
that's interesting.
You know, they're ramping up their opportunities for their free tier. I mean, it's cool that they're adding that ability for the free tier customers.
For sure.
Great. But I kind of went, does this really matter? Like,
well, it's interesting, because
is this a huge thing for people or not?
It's going to change up the licensing that they have to do. So one of the things that is dictated on the licenses that I've got is that my show is a non-interactive show, meaning that that the playlist is set by me. The user can't say, I want to listen to this song and hear that specific song. So you've got your interactive licenses and your non-interactive licenses. This pretty much goes from a non-interactive license to an interactive license for them,
for
those playlists. So it seems like this is going to cost them more money to do it. I'm curious as to what the benefit how that benefit is going to play out in subscribers, especially since it's a free tier.
Yeah, well, that, and I think the idea is that maybe they get more free tier subscribers that then convert
into paid.
Paid subscribers. You get a taste right now. You get a taste of the paid service in these 15 playlists, I guess. Right? What you would have, presumably, the ability to do. It gets me into this question. I'm really curious with streaming services. You know, are people more about I want to make playlists? I don't know where that line falls, or is it more like I said, you and I talked music discovery. So maybe this is something to throw out to the audience. It's like, how are you listening to streaming services? Are you more about I want to build a playlist of the things that I like, and that's what I want to listen to, or are you using it more like, you know, me, where it's just like shuffle, you know, this genre. I want to hear some popular punk pop, you know, and go.
Right. You know, it's funny because I even do a little bit of a hybrid of that sometimes, where I'll be listening to a quote unquote randomized playlist, a discovery list, but right clicking on the ones I like and adding them to a playlist that I might listen to on the bike. Like, oh, this would be a really good one to listen to when I'm, you know, going uphill sort of thing. And so I'll listen to those discovery songs and still make my own curated playlist from those discovered.
Yeah, me too.
Tracks.
Yeah. Me too.
So I think you could ask 20 people and you probably would get 10 different ways that they use the service, if not more.
Yeah. So I'm curious. So shoot me an email, macast@gmail.com. You guys know my email address. And let us know how you're actually using Apple Music or Spotify or whatever service. It doesn't matter what service you're using. I'm more curious about how are you using your streaming service. I'll be curious to find that out. Country music. How do you feel about country music?
I don't listen to a lot of it.
They want to go. They want to go. You know, Donny Osmond. They want to be Marie Osmond. Excuse me. They want to be a little bit more country.
That's right. He was a little bit rock and roll. She was a little bit country.
Yeah. Apparently, they're setting up shop in Nashville. Going to build a Nashville office, which I guess Spotify and Amazon already have Nashville offices with the intent of signing more country music artists. And the reason this is happening is Apple said that streaming of country music increased 66% on Apple Music in 2017.
Oh,
and
wow.
As a matter of fact, its pure country radio station is its second most popular curated playlist, the third most popular curated playlist on Apple Music, A-list country.
Oh, wow. Okay. So more country fans are discovering streaming, or at least going to this service.
Going to Apple Music.
And wow.
You know, I'm just wondering if that's a factor of them pushing sort of Apple Music more from a marketing perspective. You know, like now people's iPhones are coming, you know, they're like, you open up the music app, it's like, hey, do you want Apple Music? And so, you know, maybe people who weren't, I don't know, because they started from that Beats side of things, right?
Sure.
Their heavy focus early on was rap, hip-hop, R&B, right?
Well, and even if you look at the Apple commercials, which always have some really cool uses of music, especially like the iPhone commercials and the, you know, I remember specifically a lot of those with the people using Face ID, and it's always keyed to some really cool song. It's always some like really cool electronic or hip hop or pop song. I can't remember any commercials that Apple has done where they've used country music as a backdrop. So you wouldn't think that they would have strong ties to that, but apparently they're developing them.
And they want stronger ties now. You know, I'm curious. I don't know how much you know. I mean, I would imagine this is just a trend, especially in the U.S., though. I mean, country music is extremely popular. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how it ranks or compares with hip-hop and rap and R&B or pop music, or like, I have no idea. And now I'm kind of curious to go find out. I should have done it before the show. You know, globally and also just in the U.S., what is the most popular genre of music?
It'd be interesting to see, too, also what the trends are for when certain when fans of a certain genre make that big conversion from CDs to digital, streaming. Because I wouldn't think – I don't know. I mean, I don't know if country music, which – used to skew a lot older, but doesn't anymore. I mean, country, you know, there's country fans it seems like all generations are equally represented now. But right. It did seem to be like, you know, the older people like their country, their George Jones and their Willie Nelson and stuff like that. So you'd think it might be a slow to adopt the technological advances in music delivery, but that's probably changed from dramatically now.
I wonder how much, too, reality TV shows have influenced this.
Oh, sure.
Because I noticed that a lot of the winners of those shows, The Voice or, you know,
American Idol.
American Idol, thank you.
It's a lot of crossover country.
They generate a lot of country artists, right?
Yet when they had a show, the next country star or the next Nashville star, something like that.
Right.
I remember that show tanking after one season. And
but it's more these more mainstream shows. And I'm wondering if that's how younger generations are getting exposure to new up and coming country stars. And
sure.
Maybe that's having an impact there too.
We brought up Taylor Swift earlier. She started out as a country act and she's very much a pop crossover.
Right. And you have the other direction going on though too. That's interesting. But here's the bad side of this. This is, I don't know about you, but like I said, you know, with my Apple Music, I use the feature a lot, the like feature, because that helps, Apple learn your music tastes and you get recommendations based on those. And I am a huge fan of singer songwriters.
Sure. which is very prominent in the country world.
Yes. So I get country recommendations all the time and I like dislike. And they always seem to crop back in somehow. They like creep
are you
back
sure?
In.
Maybe you'll like the new Darius Rucker track. Maybe because he's he was Hootie, actually, but do you like him
there, there is and there is some of it that kind of blends in there, right? Yeah, I mean there's a lot of crossover pop country and you know, there is some things that I do like that are probably classified traditionally as country, but I wouldn't consider myself to be country. But it's interesting. But Apple's going to bring more country music to Apple Music. The other area that I often hear is underrepresented from a lot of people is classical for some reason. I don't know why that is.
That it's underrepresented?
Yeah. In Apple.
Yeah. And that probably is kind of what I was talking about with the country music, where classical fans might be slower to adopt technology, you know, the digital technology or the streaming technology, because they're you hear it all the time with the warmer vinyl sound of this classical piece of music, as opposed to hearing it on CD and it just sounds too clean and too polished.
Well, here's the thing though with that baffles me is, like, I would imagine for a lot of those there aren't many artist rights, and I don't know how that the licensing has to be less, right?
I would,
like, the guys that wrote this stuff are dead.
Well, yeah, but their estate still gets. That's true. I mean, is Beethoven still getting 2.3% on anybody who performs his music? That's an interesting thought. Also, streaming wise. Some of those classical pieces are like 18, 20, 25 minutes long. And you're paying one smaller price for
all this stuff factors in. You don't think about it till you start to really drill down into it.
Right.
All right. Well, I think we're getting close to wrapping up here, but I do want to talk to you about the HomePod.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of debate in the community about, is the HomePod successful? You know, should Apple make it? Should they make a cheaper one? Just some numbers to back this up. Right now, it seems like Apple's on track to sell about 2.5 to 4 million units, depending upon who this year, depending upon who you talk to. KGI and Deutsche Bank are kind of on the lower end. Strategy Analytics is a company. They did a sort of survey and looked at some sales figures, because Apple doesn't share these publicly, but they think Apple sold about 600,000 in the first quarter. So if you know, 600,000 times four, that's 2.4 million. That would be on the low end, but you have to assume in the holiday season, they're going to sell more.
Sure.
So I think that's a fair estimate, 2.5 to 4 million units. So not blowing everything away. Apple sells about 4 million max a quarter, you know, so.
Right.
So big just to difference. Put it into perspective, and, you know, iPhone's way beyond that. But so my question is, I'm pretty sure you don't have a HomePod.
I don't have one yet. I am so on the fence about getting one of these, because the way I listen to music to prepare for a show, it would not, it, using HomePod wouldn't work for me. I'd basically be using it as a, as an AirPlay speaker. Right. I'd be using it as an AirPlay speaker that apparently, for from everything that I've heard, would sound amazing.
So have you heard one? That was my follow-up question. Have you had a chance to hear one?
No, I haven't even. I was going to actually be in an Apple store earlier this week, and because it was on the way to another place we were going to in the mall, Tina decided, oh, actually, I don't need to go to Sephora, wherever she was planning on going. So I was like, oh, darn. I was really looking forward to swinging by the Apple store and actually seeing a HomePod and hearing a HomePod in person. So I haven't yet heard one of these, but all the reviews say it delivers on that aspect of it, that it does sound incredible.
I love mine. I absolutely love it. And that kind of surprised me a little bit, because I do have a Sonos. I don't know what you use. Do you use just like an AirPlay speaker or something like that? Or
nope. I've got Logitech speakers plugged into my computer that I can switch back and forth really easily. If I'm doing something with podcasting and need to have the headphones on, right, it's a really easy quick switch for me to turn the room audio off and go to the headphones.
Well, here's the other question then. Are you, because this is another thing that comes up. Are you like an out loud music family? Like, do you have speakers in the living room and you guys will just throw on music?
We do, but we usually use our Echo for that, believe it or not.
Okay.
If we're listening to music, if we're listening just to music, then we'll use the Echo. 9 times out of 10, though, I'm using Qello on the Apple TV, because I love having music videos. I love having something visual to go along with the music. I'll be working in the kitchen making food or something like that, and I'll want to hear music. For whatever reason, I'd much rather hear it with music videos that I can look up every once in a while and see what's playing.
Yeah. And, it's funny because the HomePod will work with your Apple TV, but right now it's just AirPlay, right? It's just your AirPlay.
Right, it would just be another great sounding speaker.
Yeah. Right? So, you might actually really... you need to go listen. It is a pretty amazing speaker, or not, because probably chances are if you listen to one, you're going to buy it. And especially if you're invested in Apple Music, that's what I've been telling people is what's great is we have a bunch of great options now. Like if you're all in on Amazon and that ecosystem, and that's where all your music is and stuff like that, and you want to get an Echo system or Sonos with the Echo support, I think that's a perfect way to go. But for someone like myself who's all in with Apple and Apple Music, and the HomePod has just been amazing. Now, the difference is my family is not an out loud music family. I'm the only one who really likes that. So mine lives in my office and I just use it in here.
Oh, interesting.
And I had a really nice set of Audio Engine speakers that's hooked up to my computer. And that's what I used to use through iTunes to listen to as I sit here working. But I've totally switched over to the HomePod. And a part of that is because of the Siri experience too on HomePod, which is just, it blows away any other Siri experience you'd have. To the point of detriment. Because the other day I was trying to do something on my iPad in the living room with Siri. Mm-hmm. And the HomePod in my office picked up.
Really? It heard your voice? Yeah, we'll get that occasionally with our Echo devices, that we'll be in the kitchen saying something to our Echo. What's the one with the big screen? The show?
The show.
And one of our dots or something in the other room will actually, and we'll hear both of them say, okay. Instead of it being like, oh, okay, you've got this. I'll sit back. You're closer. I think also with the HomePod, for me personally, if it was $249, for whatever reason, that seemed like that feels like a no-brainer price for me for this. Well,
yeah. So what do you think about, because there is rumors out, kind of sketchy rumors that Apple's considering doing a lower cost version of the HomePod.
Mm-hmm. So which is interesting, because
for you, it really is price point. I think kind of the sticking point.
I think usability is probably the big factor. However, I'm enough of an Apple fan that I almost say, I'll buy that and I'll figure out how to make it work with everything I do, or more, how to wedge it into my life, as opposed to the other way around. Boy, I sure wish I had a way to listen to Apple Music in the living room lot easier or with a lot better sound. It's usually like, oh, I'll get that. And you know what? I'll be able to listen to, I'll use that and I'll start listening to music in the living room.
Well, and then there's also the home automation side of it too, because I think you have a lot of home automation going on in your house, right? And it's probably not, and I think it's not HomeKit stuff.
It's not. No, it's primarily Echo. It's you know.
So that's where it falls over a bit for you. Specifically with regards to the price, right? It suddenly becomes a little bit harder to justify because it's like, well, I can get the HomePod, but it's not going to work with any of my home automation very easily. You know, I know you could figure out the
easily would the switch
Raspberry
things over.
Raspberry Pi Homebridge thing, which is what I use for my Nest. I don't know if you're aware of that, but you can take a Raspberry Pi and there's a thing called Homebridge you can run on it that will act as a bridge between non-HomeKit devices.
Oh, really?
And HomeKit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that, but now I will be.
it's an open source kind of thing, so different people write different add-ons and plugins. They don't have it for everything, but for a lot of things you can find. And it's kludgy. It's not like as good as the native stuff, right?
But well, now I'm willing to up my price point to $279. $279 now is
well,
my price.
Well, so, you know, they're saying Apple looking at things as low as $99 or $199. Oh, wow.
But it would be a stripped down lower
that's just the
quality.
The thing is, like, I don't get what they're going to get cut out because, you know, really Apple was playing to the speaker side of things. And I think that's where the HomePod is getting dinged a lot is that it's not, you know, it's not this smart speaker that's going to compete with like a Google Home or an Amazon Echo. And my opinion is, I don't think that was ever the intent from the very beginning. You know, it was more about being an Apple Music accessory than a Home Assistant accessory. And then they kind of the history of it is that actually there was a team of Mac audio engineers that wanted to do a high-end speaker to compete with like Sonos, and they were working on this thing, and then the Amazon came along and somebody said, hey, we need to do this too. And then somebody else said, oh, hey, there's these guys working on this speaker thing. You should go talk to them. And so it was kind of shoehorned in.
Interesting.
Which is why it feels a little bit like that, I think.
If they were to come out with a HomePod version that took out the personal assistant features and made it an AirPlay speaker that still did the whole room, you know, figuring out the size of the room and adjusting things to that. No brainer for me. I'd pick
that
up in a heartbeat.
That is interesting. We haven't heard that as a rumor, but that is, I mean, that would be a way to go. That it's just, especially in light of the fact that they're killing off the Airport Express, which is how you would do that now, right? You'd buy a speaker and you plug an Airport Express into it. So having a sort of satellite option, and that would actually even be good with AirPlay 2 coming out, especially if it paired, you know, the stereo pairing or the multi-room pairing with your main HomePod.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Right. So you have the HomePod sort of central unit that you stick in the living room that does all the Siri stuff and stuff like that. And then you have these sort of just satellite HomePods, right?
Right. Maybe
call up music on, but that's about it.
I mean, even if it did that, you know, I've got Siri on my phone. I've got the Apple remote app on my phone.
Right.
Which can control the library and control Apple Music on my desktop. I actually wouldn't even need that because I'd be able to play to those AirPlay speakers from my iPhone's Apple Music,
right?
And it would sound good. So I,
also
you know,
your
for
Apple
me,
TV,
right? Apple, right? Apple TV as well. So really, just having it as a non-digital assistant smart speaker would be the way to go. Just a speaker. Well, smart enough to do that whole like figuring out the room size and adjusting to that. Right. That's a feature that I
interesting. Yeah, no, we haven't heard that. It's been more like, oh, they're going to do a cheaper version to compete with, you know, Amazon. And I don't buy that because that's just not historically what Apple cares about. And that's been my frustration with a lot of the comparisons is like, I don't even think that Apple even considers that they're trying to go after the Amazon Echo market or the Google Home market. I think it's just not even something that's in their playbook. They want to do their thing and make that experience the best experience they can, both from an audio level and from a home assistant level. And they're happy to sell 4 million units in the first year, even though it's not blowing the doors off of, you know, the tens and if not, I don't know how many millions of Echoes are being sold at this point, but they're probably selling tens of millions a month.
I would think so.
I haven't looked at the latest number. So, finally, do you own AirPods?
I do. Love AirPods.
I was going to say, what do you think about your AirPods? I honestly have not found a single person who owns AirPods that doesn't love them.
Right. The only complaint about the AirPods that I have has nothing to do with the AirPods themselves. I'm really good about hygiene, about my own hygiene.
Right.
Yet no matter what, I can look inside that AirPod case. Yeah. And it's like looking into the jaws of Hades. It's like, oh my God, what's the matter with me? I need to.
They do get pretty nasty. So AirPod cleaning is an important thing to do, folks.
Yes, for
Keep
sure.
your AirPods for sure. clean.
That's right. We talked about that on TMS today. Just basically, when you go to the dentist and they give you that free toothbrush, you've already got a good toothbrush at home. Don't worry about using that for brushing your teeth. Use it to clean your AirPods.
Yep. I get a little toothpick and kind of work out the crevices. And
exactly.
Nice soft cloth. Wipe that down. Maybe a little, maybe just dampen it. Just a tad.
That's right. But no, I love these are my favorite Apple product in the last 5 years.
I would totally agree with that. I absolutely love mine too. Well, cool.
Just the fact you pair them with one thing and they work with everything else instantly. Oh.
All right. Well, I think that rounds it out for us, unless you have any other Apple things that are sort of in your craw that you want to bring up, but otherwise.
No, I think we pretty much covered the gamut of it.
That was fun. That was wonderful. I got exactly what I wanted from you. So thank you so much for coming on finally. And we need to get you back more often. Just to kind of round things out, I promised everybody, you've been in the podcast industry as long as I have, I think, and you have a number of shows and things that you're doing. You want to let people know where they can kind of find all that stuff and what you're up to.
Yeah, the biggies are Coverville at coverville.com. That's the music show I've been doing since 2004. Focusing on independent artists that do really transformative cover songs. I do a daily comedy podcast with Scott Johnson, comedy news variety show called The Morning Stream. You can find that at frogpants.com/TMS. And then the new thing that I was talking about earlier, Soundography, spelled just like it sounds, Soundography. You can find it at soundography.com. And we're in our fourth season now of doing the entire libraries of bands and artists that that we check out. So
yeah. I'll put in my recommendation for all of those shows. Of them are excellent. My personal favorite is Morning Stream. It's how I get my fix from Scott. Used to do a show called Extra ELR. Life Radio. Yeah.
Yes.
And so it's kind of become my new replacement for that. I don't get to listen all that frequently because I work from home, but when I do, usually Tuesdays and Thursdays are my two favorite days, but do that, what, 4 or 5 days? Are you five days a week now?
Yeah. And no promises, but you and I are both on the AAC chapterized bandwagon. We love creating a chapterized version. And, you know, when we listen to other podcasts, we're bummed when they don't have a chapterized version.
Right.
There's talk. Scott and I are talking about potentially doing a chapterized version of TMS for patrons. So if there are segments you don't like, you can just jump right over them. Or more importantly,
I like all the segments. I just have limited time to listen. So.
I was going to say, if you like a segment a lot, you can go back to the beginning and listen to it again.
And I'll also put a plug. I mean, Hammond, who you do Soundography with, is an awesome dude. And I really Hammond a lot. And that's a great show, too. So especially if you're into music, Brian has a couple of great, really great shows for you. And you should definitely check them out. But Brian, hey, man, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure, Adam. Thanks for having me.
So there you go. Brian Ibbett from Coverville, also Film Sack. Let's see, The Morning Stream. He does a bunch of great podcasts. And if you're not listening to or subscribing to some of those, I really do encourage you to go check those out. But with that is going to do it for this special episode of the MacCast. I really hope you did enjoy it. As I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and once again thank our sponsor, Smile. You can check out all of their great applications, PDF Pen, Text Expander, also PDF Pen Scan Plus, and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with Text Expander for iOS. You can get more information and details about all their great applications by checking out smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave a voicemail there. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me online between shows, you'll find me on social media on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the Google Plus community. That's at google.com/PlusMacCast. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.